Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And welcome to episode 9 of Old Brother, a podcast about legendary musical institution The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. You can find us at all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. You can search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by the legendary Martin Brama, main man of the Blue Orchids and Factory Star, and of course founding member of the group we're all here to talk about. Hope you enjoy it.
Episode of Old Brother, a Fall podcast with me, Paul Hanley, and my brother, Stephen Hanley. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
So we've got to be on our best behaviour today. We've got a founding member of The Fall, and who was our boss for a bit as well in Factory Star, so have to be nice and polite. So without further ado, Mr. Martin Brama, how are you, mate?
I'm all right, thanks, yeah. Nice to chat to you both again. I'd just like to crack a can in honour of the man that's brought us together once again.
Yeah. Okay. Drink to that. Very good. Yes.
There you go. Now I can start slagging him off.
Right. Okay.
I was joking.
Right. Okay. To put the phrase, we're going to go back. So, pre the Sex Pistols gig, and this is the, how it always gets printed. You were sort of a band, but you were hadn't played live. Is that right? Is that the
Sex? Well, yeah, that's right. We were just a gang of mates hanging out, listening to the same sort of music. And we kind of felt like we were a band, you know what I mean? We were a gang. We were going to become a band, because that was the way it went.
So you did talk about actually being a band then?
Yeah. It's just a dream, like, you know, teenage lads did. Mm.
Yeah.
I'd known Mark a couple of years, even before we saw the Sex Pistols, so we'd been hanging out for a couple of years. I remember going to see Lou Reed in 1974 at the Free Trade Hall with Mark, for instance, and we were all wearing our Velvet Underground wraparound shades and black turtlenecks, and there was Lou Reed was going through the funky white boy phase, of course, so he was met with disapproval, of course.
You must have been the coolest people in there. I don't suppose anybody else thought you were in their, double denim and what have you, but way ahead of the game.
Yeah.
So do you think there's anything in that, Martin? Is there anything in the thing that, having seen the Sex Pistols, that was what made people form bands? Was that true for you? Was that what gave you the push?
It really is, actually. We saw them, I think, four times in 1976. We saw the two Lesser Free Trade Hall gigs. Then we saw the Anarchy in the UK tour, which came to Manchester twice.
Wow.
So by December, we'd seen the Pistols like four times, and but throughout that 6 month period from like June to December, we were thinking fast and we knew we just needed a drummer. We had some ragged ideas for songs, and we were, you know, we were messing about on guitars, you know.
And how? And what about the thing that originally Mark was going to be the guitarist, you were going to be the vocalist?
Yeah, that's kind of true. Mark said that. I mean, I wouldn't have put it like that myself, but it's true. He had an electric guitar. He had a cheap Les Paul copy, black Les Paul copy. But, it, you know, it's like he's just diddling about on it, never learned any chords and such. But he could play a nice discordant kind of riff, you know what I mean? But it didn't really take to it. His timing wasn't very good. He wasn't very, you know what I mean? He wasn't going to be a guitarist. That was obvious anyway, so... But, yeah, and I had an acoustic, and I was already in another band where I was the singer. So, you know, we were hanging out and throwing ideas around, but quickly became apparent that Mark had a way with words, you know, and he would be a singer of sorts, you know.
I mean, you could have both done both, couldn't you? You could have been like, you know, Squeeze or Buzzcocks. That would have been an interesting...
I actually did used to sing a song in the fall set back in, like, 78. One Kay wrote the words for.
I remember it. I've still got that riff in my head.
What was it called?
I forgot.
But that's how it went, wasn't it? Great song.
Yeah. That's the one I sang.
Yeah, I remember it.
I mean, I sang half of Rebellious Jukebox as well, but our vocal sounds are so similar, not a lot of people notice that. Anyway.
You must be joking. You sound like him.
Yeah.
Right, so I was talking, funnily enough, to John Marr, drummer at Buzzcocks, and he was at the Falls' first gig. It was at the Northwest Arts.
Yeah,
that's right. Drummer.
I'd invited Pete Shelley down. I'd met Pete Shelley in the Ranch Bar the week before. We had this gig coming up, our first gig. And I just said to Pete Shelley, you know, I'm in a punk band. We're playing Northwest Arts, you know. And he brought Devoto, Richard Boone, himself. We're all in the audience for that first world gig. And the next gig was supporting the Buzzcocks in London.
Right. Where was that?
North London Poly.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So how many people were at the first gig?
That was Carl's first gig, because after the first gig, we got rid of that temporary drummer. And I said to Mark, I know this guy is a real good drummer, but he hates punk rock. And to be honest, he wasn't keen on Mark Smith either. But when we told him we had a gig in London, we got Carl in. That's how Carl joined for the second gig.
The bright lights. He was lured by the bright lights of London.
He was, yeah. I took Mark to see him play with this local hard rock band in the Conservative Club. And surprisingly, Carl was up for the gig, yeah. He never looked back, of course.
I mean, that must have been a right difference, that, once you got Carl in, because he was a different class, wasn't he? I mean, if you look at the other Manchester bands then, I mean, he had some great drummers, like Steve Morris and what have you, and John Marr was brilliant, but he was
in a league of his own, yeah. I mean, I'd known Carl for a few years. We've been mates, you know, since our early teens. And so I remember the first time he sat behind a drum kit round at his girlfriend's house. His girlfriend's mum was going out with somebody in a fucking local band, sorry to swear, called Mad Attic. Anyway, Carl just sat behind this kit that was in the back living room, and he could just play it. That was Carl, you know. He could pick up a guitar and play it with a matchstick. He never had any lessons. He just got behind the kit and started playing it.
So he never had lessons, Carl? He never had lessons. That's completely self-taught, is it?
Yeah.
I'm sure he told me that he did loads of gigs in Germany for some cabaret band.
He was playing in the kind of heavy rock cabaret band. They were just doing covers of all the standards, you know. I don't know where he went on tour with him. I can't remember, but he could have gone to Germany with him. But then you know what Carl's like.
He went to Germany with him, left halfway through the tour, pitched around Germany and rejoined for
last year. That's my fondest memory.
Yeah, that's true. I remember he once showed me a picture on the street of Hitler with these two generals, and they put a biro circle around the head of one of these generals, and he was telling us, "That's my dad." This is when he's about 14. Hitler's assistants, you know. He was big fan of German culture, shall we say.
I know, yeah. That's it. Sound of Music's his favourite film. Full of Nazis and nuns.
Yeah.
So the Buzzcocks were quite good to the Fall in them early days, weren't they?
Yeah. They were great benefactors in the early days, yeah.
You paid for the
Bigger Masses Breakout EP, you paid for that to be recorded, yeah.
Yeah. Because I was reading somewhere that they were going to put it out, but then they ended up signing to United Artists, so the label kind of went by the wayside.
That's pretty much what happened, yeah. Yeah, Richard Boone just got really busy working with United Artists, which he was kind of reluctant to do, if I remember rightly, but that Buzzcocks wanted to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously. But so New Almonds just got put on the back burner and never really did anything after that. But yeah.
So what I'll have to know the timings of how Steve Garvey ended up in Buzzcocks around about the time Mark joined on bass for the Falls. Is that about the right same time?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah. I mean, Steve Garvey was another schoolmate of mine, and he was a really good bass player. And Pete Shelley said, you know, when Garth left, Pete Shelley said to me, we're looking for a new bass player. And I said, you know, Steve's a great bass player. Give him an audition. So he got an audition and got the job.
He was a good fit.
Brilliant bass player.
Yeah, he played in Blue Orchids with Nico in Europe as well a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Huh?
In 82, I think. Yeah, he did a stint.
Right. Well, that would have been just after they split then, won't it? I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, hang on, where are we now? So you've just played London for the first time. Did you do a lot of gigs early on? Or was it quite sporadic then? Or how well organised were you early on?
Well, it was a bit of a blur now, but we seem pretty busy. But you know, when it's all new, so even one gig a month it seems pretty busy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you're starting out.
Yeah.
So we were just getting gigs here and there, Manchester, London, Liverpool, was kind of.
You were managing yourselves then, were you?
Yeah. Kind of. We were. Tony Friel was kind of. Fancied himself he was managing us, you know, all the band members. You know, and then, of course, Kay came along and we thought it'd be a good idea for her to manage us. And then, of course, it became much more Mark's vehicle at that point because he was leaving, you know.
So is that where you see the sort of the tilt from Collective to Mark E. Smith? And
yeah, when Tony left, really. Tony left because he didn't like it. It was over one night. We were picking up the money somewhere in Manchester. I think we played the Squat somewhere. Can't remember where. It might have been the university. But we're getting in the van, and Tony's been to get the money off the promoter, and he's already given it K. So he's like, who took the fucking... who took the money? K's got it. That's my job, you know. So anyway, so Matt told him where to get off and that K was doing it from now on. So they had a bit of a set to. I ended up punching Mark that night, actually.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah,
over all that. Only Tony left and I didn't leave, but I did punch him. But I got pulled off by John the Postman and a few other hangers-on who were around the van. Yeah. That's the first time we'd actually come to blows.
So was that kind of the first problem for Tony, or had it been building up to...
It had been building up. He didn't like Kay's guts, and I don't know. You know, Tony's... his own man, and he had his own ideas, and he didn't think the Fall was going the way he wanted to go, so you know, he'd had enough by the first few months, because him and Mark had been such close mates like the previous year, or you know what I mean, but they'd fallen out. So
there's all them letters, isn't there?
That's right, Mark was right typing out all those letters. Interesting.
Yeah, so then when Eric came along, was who picked Eric then? Was he a mate of yours or?
No, that he came through Mark and Kay, but really through John Cooper Clark. But you know, it's obviously a conversation that was had probably in a bar between Mark, Kay and Clark that Eric would be a good replacement. Yeah, so he just turned up at rehearsals one day.
Right.
Yeah.
So you weren't worried about your position being slipping away by that point, were you? Or
give me no.
I don't mean they were going to sack you. I mean that you were less of, you know, it was less down to you because you know you should be consulted about who the bass player is, really, shouldn't you? You would think.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, well, I don't remember being, but I wasn't that arsed. I mean, it's just is the new guy. Let's get see if he's any good. I mean, he was an old.
But you didn't know Eric then? Because
I
assumed you knew him.
Not really, no. Not as I remember it. No, he was a new face to me when he turned up.
He can't have been in long, can he, Eric?
No, he wasn't. But it made quite an impression. I got on with him really well, obviously, because he ended up starting Blue Orchids with him when I left the Fall a year later, or whenever it was. I mean, the thing is, we started rehearsing at Eric's because he had this big... between him, John Cooper Clark, and a lad called Steve, who was a painter, I forget his name now, they had like a whole... sort of Victorian semi-detached in Sedgley Park, and Eric had the ground floor, and so we started rehearsing in his back room anyway, and Clarky was on the second floor.
So is that where the Granada Reports was filmed?
No, that was in a little studio. A studio that was in a basement. I'm not sure if it was Strawberry 1 before they had Strawberry 2. I think because Tony Wilson just booked this, you know, this basement of a studio, and we filmed it there. Yeah.
Right. Ah, right. I always thought that was John Cooper Clarke's house. You filmed that?
That first Granada Reports thing, Psycho Mafia, and just the play and that. No, we were down in sort of a basement. There was some kind of studio, but yeah, Tony Wilson had booked it. We went there. Yeah.
Right. I know it's looking bad, but it seems quite an easy process then, doesn't it? Do you know what I mean? I know
it was the right place, right time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we were just thinking the right things at the right. We had our fingers on the pulse. What can you say? The music.
Oh yeah. I don't mean that you didn't deserve it. It's just that it seemed like there was a path there for every. You know, not just a fall, but like
It doesn't seem like you had trouble getting gigs.
No, it seemed to come quite easily to us. Yeah. We took that kind of for granted in our arrogance. I think that this is all meant to be.
So then obviously Mark joined, Mark Riley, and that was you did the Bingo Masters. Did you record that Bingo Masters? Was that in London?
No, that was in Manchester. Again, don't ask me the name of the studio. That was the first time I'd been in a recording studio, and I can't remember the name, but even now. Blur.
Don't bother looking for it. It's not there anymore.
But it was in Manchester somewhere.
So then Tony went, and then how long then was it before Una went then?
Pretty soon after Tony, actually. Oh, yeah.
So are we not going to talk about Eric going then?
Well, whichever way around you want. Yeah. I think because Una went before Eric was forced. As I remember it. I can't remember. It was winter. I can't remember the date when she left. Because the thing was with Una was her and Mark had been a couple. When I met them, I met Mark and Una as a couple. So they were this couple with their own sort of take on things. A bit of the John and Yoko of Presswich, you might say. only joke. But so Una had decided she wanted to be in an open relationship with Mark and started seeing this other guy. And Mark went along with that. You know, he's quite passive about it, really. And then Kay moved in on Mark once he was available, and that's when Kay turned up. She was like Una's best mate from the mental hospital, Presswich hospital, and so she was a mate of Una's. And when Una sort of moved out of the shared flat with Mark, Kay quickly moved in.
It's like Fleetwood Mac, isn't it?
Yeah, and Una soon after left the band, because she was going out with Johnny Brown, who was the other bass player who was briefly in the band.
Yeah.
I think
He did the sleeve for Bingo Masters, is that right?
Yeah, he did. And he must have been before Eric, because he was living somewhere in Charlton, and Una sort of moved in with him. And so he didn't last long, because Mark didn't like him, obviously, because he was with Una. These only lasted months, though, a couple of months or so. But then Eric's leaving.
It's never musical differences, is it?
Well, no, it's always the girl, isn't it?
I was going to say, seems like a trivial reason to leave, and then we'll move on to Steve Davis's Hawaiian shirt.
Exactly. So Eric, the day Eric left was our first John Peel session in Maida Vale. And I think it was a mate of Kay's, that guy. What was he called?
Steve Davis.
Yeah, Steve Davis. So he had the Hawaiian shirt and also the congas in the back. Because he said he'd drive us to London if he could play congas on one song, which was Everybody's Jukebox.
Yeah. I suppose he'd get the BBC fee, wouldn't he, if he played on one song?
I guess he was. Thinking of that. So Eric sees this guy and sees the congas and says, I'm not getting in the van if he's driving it. So we're like, okay, it came down as like, okay, see you later, and we drove off. What we did was, I says, look, drive us up to Tony Friel's house, I'll borrow his bass. So we drove up to Simister, knocked on Tony's door, just going to borrow your bass, we've got a John Peel session. Not like, come and play bass for us.
I was going to say, what the show?
I know, it didn't occur to me at the time. It's just like, can I borrow your bass? He says, yeah. So I kind of stuck Tony's bass in the back of the van, went off, and of course, I'd played bass on guitar on that first session, and Mark Riley was the roadie. After the session, it was like, we need a bass player. You're the man, you know. So he was in after that, really. Yeah.
Because there's that famous picture of band on the wall Kevin Cummins took with Mark's first gig, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That must have been pretty soon after that.
Yeah, but he kind of knew all the songs already. You know, I knew all the bass lines. I sort of simplified all the bass lines, which is that classic four bass sound, you see.
Yeah, definitely.
It's simple, isn't it, Steve?
How do you play? So you played it on a right-handed bass that session?
Yeah, it's only four strings.
Yeah, but they're the wrong way up.
You don't have to play any chords, you know.
I don't know how you did it. I tell you what, though, they're pretty good, the congas on the Rebellious Jukebox.
Yeah.
They're all right, yeah. We didn't use them on the album for some reason, though. On the album version.
No. We did. He came back for one gig with when I joined. We played a gig, and he was, I think he was driving at that as well. And he played. He got up for Rebellious Jukebox. That was quite good. Good, that.
Yeah. Okay. Sort of a Mickey Finn of the Fall.
Yeah, indeed. There's only, I think, Yvonne, who I've not played Rebellious Jukebox with, who's played on that, I think.
Right. Yeah.
Oh no, I don't know. Maybe I haven't done Rebellious Jukebox with Carl. Actually, I can't remember ever doing it with two drummers.
It seems unlikely, doesn't it?
It does.
You wouldn't be needed if he was there.
He wouldn't have let me, to be fair. He wouldn't have let me get my hands on it.
Yeah. No.
So then that's a relatively... We've not got to Yvonne yet, have we? You got Yvonne from an advert in a paper? Is that right?
Yeah, Yvonne was great. Total respect for her contribution. She's often forgotten about, really.
Yeah.
She played on Witch Trials. She did a great job. She's gone on... It's the new thing in Various Times, which Various Times is a classic fall. It's like a template for a lot of things that came later.
I mean, that's a great lineup, that, isn't it? That Witch Trials and It's the New Thing lineup. I mean, everyone's on the top of the game there. I mean,
everybody's pretty reliable in that lineup, you know.
Yeah.
We could have been relied on, except the management was annoying us all so much.
Well, I've always said I thought that lineup could have been a really big, like sort of U2-y kind of, if it was stuck together.
Who knows?
That we need another world necessary leads of the U2, or it would have been a good idea.
Yeah.
But you had the potential, didn't you?
I guess so. Who knows? Things turn out as they do.
Yeah, and then so you've got this fantastic lineup where everybody's brilliant, and then Carl leaves and you get Mike Leigh. That's the next thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm taking that wasn't your idea.
No, it wasn't my idea, no. That's true. It was Mark's idea. He liked the teddy boy look, Mark, you know.
Yeah.
And he thought that would mean you'd get a simple beat with just a strong snare backbeat, which is...
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, I guess he got with a few rototoms thrown in for free.
Oh, well, they should have been thrown somewhere.
So, do we know why Carl left the first time?
It was a surprise to me. He left after the Marquee. I think it was the second time we played the Marquee, and it was a pretty riotous night. And...
Was I there? I was possibly there.
He might have been. You know, it's all a bit of a blur. It was a long time ago. Who was there? He might have been there. The audience were quite aggressive to us that night. I remember smacking some chained-up punk in the mouth.
Nice.
Yeah, you get thrown.
I'm getting a lot of you punching people here, man.
I was a wild youth, wasn't I?
You were.
So was that when Carl auditioned for Iggy Pop? Was that just after he left?
No. That was like 86, I think.
Well, was it? Oh, right.
86, yeah, because we had Thirst at the time.
Yeah.
So I was a bit miffed with him going off to audition for other people because we were starting off this band Thirst, me and Carl. Anyway, but he had this audition and he was really bricking it. And so for 2 weeks in the rehearsal rooms, I was just playing studio songs with him. And he made me go with him to London to the actual audition and just to hold his hand, you know.
Yeah.
So I was there in the lounge of the rehearsal space, yeah. So I got to meet Jim, Iggy.
You don't hold a grudge then, do you? You were miffed with him going off to...
Mildly, yeah.
But I just played all the songs with him and went with him to hold his hand for the audition. You don't do miffed very well, I have to say.
Yeah. Guess not. No. See you like that. Well, he asked me to go with him, so, you know. Three trips to London. Got to meet Iggy Pop. Iggy comes out of the rehearsal room in the middle of Carl's audition and says, "Has anybody got any towels for the drummer?" He was sweating that much.
Don't blame me.
Yeah, he was really bricking it, Carl, over that audition. And he didn't get it.
Yeah, that surprises me about Carl.
Hoping to listen to this. I don't mean to slag you off, Carl.
No, no. Well, I was going to say, but I was.
No, that's quite endearing, really. It's the, yeah. You know.
I was going to say about Mike Lee. I don't think the lineup with you and Mike and Mark and Yvonne worked massively well, but he kind of worked once Craig and Steve came in, didn't it? I think.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, that's true. There was a little period of transition needed. It's a big change, as you say, from Carl's style to Mike's style, and the power, the energy was kind of a lower level. It didn't quite have the power and energy we were used to, so we had to adapt. You know, to a more contained sort of sound, but it's quirky and interesting and original. I mean,
and what songs came about in that time?
I don't know if we wrote much in that period.
Figure Walks was there was a few on there, wasn't there?
No, Figure Walks was actually an early song.
Was it?
Well, I think so. Yeah, now maybe I'm getting it mixed up with Your Heart Out. Anyway, yeah, Figure Walks might have been from Mike's time. You might be right, actually. Yeah. Sorry, I was getting the two songs mixed up.
And Printhead, that was one of them, wasn't it?
Printhead, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I know more about it than you used to. I was only a callow youth, and I know more about it than you used to.
Well, you know, it's hard to remember who was in the room when we were playing what song, you know. Sure, you understand that, Steve. Is he there?
I can remember it all, fortunately.
Yeah, was that that first gig? Well, me and Steve were both there, weren't we? That Bowden gig you did, Mike's first gig, when you'd obviously raided his dressing up box.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So is that true then? Hang on, before we get to where I was going to ask, so what happened then for you going? What was the big thing for you?
Oh, yeah, you know, it's kind of difficult because we're all in each other's pockets, you know, we all knew each other too well. And Kay was starting to interfere in my private life as I saw it, you know. Generally, you know, it was difficult the way Mark was taking over. He wasn't asking people who wrote what. He was just writing out the writing credits, you know, and sending them off.
What do you think of that, Steve? It's good we stopped doing that, isn't it?
That's
the gripe, isn't it? But this is the start of that, you know.
Yeah.
So I was annoyed about that, but it wasn't a deal breaker. It wasn't the end of everything. But these were the little niggles. And then when Kay started coming around and telling me who I should be seeing and who I shouldn't be seeing and all this, it's like, you know, just get out of my life, woman. You know what I mean?
Right.
You run the band, but you're not telling me. I think that was the last straw when Kay turned up on my doorstep about, you know, some incident.
Right.
Some lady at the time that I got involved with briefly. Don't want to name any names, but that was the last straw. I've probably not said that before because generally, you know, it's just all kinds of stuff coming to a head.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I was the last remaining original member. I was surrounded by all these, by then, you know, people that Mark had got on board, I suppose. You know, I don't know. So I just decided to leave and do something else. At that point, I'd had enough of Kay, really, more than Mark. I think the two of them together could be...
It could be difficult.
Difficult. Difficult to work for or with, you know. I mean, I know you're...
Especially if you've come from it from the beginning. You know, like, it was obviously a bit different from me because I'd seen the setup and I'd seen how it was running.
You know, you're getting into the movie.
This band, they've already been through four bass players.
Yeah. 6 months.
It's probably a temporary gig, didn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, the other side of that Mark and Kay thing, they were quite dynamic, weren't they, in a way? They got quite a bit done.
Yeah, obviously, they were a great combination as far as the outside world goes, as far as getting the early fall somewhere goes. Yeah, I mean, you can see it all in retrospect.
Yeah.
But at the time, they were just starting to be a pain in the arse, and, you know, I don't know, I'd been in the fall for 2 years. I'd known Mark for years before that. We just sort of fell out.
Yeah.
It was an intense period. And, you know, we got sick of the sight of the pair of them at that point. So,
right.
Just as weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big fan of Mark, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
Brilliant writer. And what a man. You know,
that's the thing that we've been saying this about on this podcast. Everybody we speak to who's been in the band and you've seen lots of interviews and interviews where people, you know, might not come across as massively happy, but everybody comes across as a real big fan of Mark E. Smith. You know, that's the thing. Yeah. Obviously, you'd have to be, wouldn't you, to be in the fall? You couldn't.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So how long between you leaving? And was it at the Iggy Pop gig? That was where it happened.
It was. I was actually the on-stage security at that gig. Alan Wise got me the the gig on stage, keeping the girls off Iggy Pop. Tough job.
Yeah.
So I was on stage security, me and Eric, actually. But, and that night, Matt was there in the audience, and after the show, I took him to one side and says, "Look, I'm leaving. Bad enough."
And how did he take it? He must have been a bit...
He was really upset about it, actually, because, you know, he didn't want me to leave. At that point, it would have seemed I'd be hard to replace, although it turns out I wasn't, of course. But, he was upset about it. He told me I was doing a stupid thing and things were going to be really going places soon and all that. Gubbins gave me his best pep talk, but, of course, I'd made my mind up, so...
Right.
Yeah, he wasn't happy about it.
And did you know what you were going to do? Did you have plans, or did you just want to be not in the fall?
Yeah, I was just going to take some else, start the Blue Orchids, as it turned out, obviously. But
yeah.
No, I didn't go with a master plan.
Right, okay.
And Matt told everyone I was leaving to join Susie and the Banshees, which really pissed me off, because I knew he was going to be doing that.
Where did he get that from?
Out of thin air. I think they were looking for a guitar.
I suppose they were looking for a guitar at the time.
I never answered the ad because I wasn't interested.
Well, I mean, was that when they got John McGough, then?
Might be.
Because I never realised he was... He's Manchester, wasn't he? He was living with Malcolm Garrett and and hanging around with Linda and that. So he was on the scene as well.
Yeah. He was in Magazine, wasn't he?
Magazine, yeah.
Yeah. He was a great guitarist.
Yeah, I've chatted to him a few times at gigs and stuff back in those days, yeah. He was a pair of... Me in the fall and that, and he was a great player, great guitar.
So, how quickly did it take you to get Blue Orchids together then?
Oh, a good few months. You know, too many drugs involved.
Yeah,
it wasn't like we weren't up and running by within a month. Yeah, it must have been most of '79. We were messing about, rehearsing with various people. I mean, Carl was in the band for a while on drums. We had Tony Friel on bass for a while, but.
You, Carl Ooner and Tony Friel, were it at one stage?
Yeah, it was. But it wasn't. It just wasn't working. Believe it or not, it didn't sound right. So
you would think that would be a good combination.
You would think that.
Yeah.
But the I don't know, the vibe wasn't there. Something right. wasn't.
Is it true that you showed Craig the songs?
I did, as I remember it. I don't know what Craig remembers. But he came around to my flat. I had a little flat in Sedgley Park at the time, and he came around one night with his guitar, and I just left the band, and he was getting the job. And somehow it was a negotiation between, probably Mark Riley suggested it. He came around just for one night, and I just showed him the basic riffs for the set, as it was then. So.
All right.
Yeah, I did do that. I know Craig's his own man, and he's got his own style, but, I did give him that way into the fall songs, as it were, then, yeah.
You got a bit short shrift on the credits for those songs on Dragnet, didn't you?
Well, I think. Yeah, apparently. I didn't even think about that for years, but it's been pointed out to me that obviously I wrote a few of those songs before I left and my name's not mentioned, but I'd got used to that by then. So.
Well, if you get used to that when you're in the band, it's not really a surprise when you're not.
No. He tried to write me out of the history of the band for a while. He went through a phase of saying the fall started in '79. The real fall, you guys.
Funny.
Did you ever read that? I did, of course.
No, I've never seen that.
My memory.
So then, how long were the Blue Orchids are going concerned then? So you're saying about 19, started about 80, was it? You got really good going?
Yeah, really sort of, end of 79, but really sort of, I think it's 1980 really in my mind, because that's when we did some demos, got them to Rough Trade. Jeff Travis was interested in, so we started recording for Rough Trade and got our first single out, I think, at the end of 1980, The Flood.
So was it enough to live on then, or were you did you make enough money? I mean, I know people lived pretty frugally in those days, and the fall.
I was living pretty frugally. Yeah, no, I mean nobody was paying us a wage at Rough Trade. No, I mean I was signing on, of course, like every other musician.
Yeah,
with a bit of extra money from gigs and records and that, but they were different times. Yeah,
they were. I mean, it was possible to live, wasn't it, by signing on in them days?
Yeah.
I'm not so sure it is now, but certainly not living being a band like that.
Yeah,
I don't think you could do it now.
No way.
I was going to say, as it's the fall podcast, we're going to have to skip ahead a bit now to the end of the decade when Steve's
We're not going there, are we?
I think we're going to have to, I'm afraid, Stephen. So,
extra gates.
Yeah, we're looking at the... So the end of... So 80... Was it 88, I think? Hang on, let me get my notes. I'm trying to get my timeline. So the end of 88, Bricks went.
Yeah.
And then... I was talking to Steve earlier, and the beginning of 89, the fall did kind of nothing for six months.
Mm.
Well, they didn't do any gigs. So, and Steve was saying that a lot of that was recording. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah. Well, I you'd already started recording backing tracks for Extricate before I became an official member again, hadn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the reason I rejoined, I mean, I'd heard Bricks had left. I just stopped working with Carl. First, had kind of disintegrated. And I thought, well, you know, it's like 10 years since me and Mark fell out. I've still got his phone number. So I just phoned him up and said, do you fancy doing a bit of writing together? And he said, yeah. So I went down to his house with my guitar.
Right.
At first, I didn't join the Fall straight away, but I wrote three songs with him. And then he says to me one day, a few weeks later, Craig and Steve think it'd be a good idea if you rejoin the band. He says, I'm not sure about it, but do you fancy it? So that's how he put it, in typical Mark. You know, Craig and Steve think it'd be a good idea. I'm not so sure. But
so was that you pushing for that, Steve, was it?
Yeah. It came up in some conversation. There's going to be a replacement for Brick somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
And Craig and I thought it'd be great to get you in here.
Yeah.
So is that if you were just writing, is that reason why it's credited to M. Beddington then, because you didn't want
to... Yeah, I told him specifically not to use that name, but he did anyway. I'd everything set up with Brahma as my pen name, you know, for all legal reasons.
Yeah.
My real name is Beddington, Martin Beddington, but I've always been known as Martin Brahma, so that's like my pen name, my stage name, whatever you want.
Yeah.
And I'd explain that to Mark, you know, just keep crediting me as Brahma, but he'd seen my passport and decided to... I should be Beddington, that's my real name, you know. So he took it into his own hands to credit me as Beddington, which muddies the waters, doesn't it? If people don't know.
He probably had some reason for that, I don't know. But.
Well, he was, at that point, he was really difficult, wasn't he? That year, I felt like he only let me join so he could punish me for leaving last time. In the first place.
I don't know. I think for a lot of that year, we were pretty professional and pretty together.
We were, yeah. We were as a band, weren't we?
Yeah.
It was a great unit, but. It was just always having digs all the time.
Yeah. I was looking at that. There's like a list of the gigs at the beginning of 89. You went everywhere, didn't you?
We did.
Busy year, wasn't it? Yeah.
It's not like UK, then Europe, then the US, then Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then Japan for some of you.
I didn't get to Japan.
I know.
Brazil was the first time we got on a plane together, I think. But
good God, it was a bit of a long one then.
Tucano Festival, 12-hour flight, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There you have that. So I came back into the fall. I phoned up Mark. And then obviously Craig and Steve got wind of it. And it's a great idea on paper.
So do you regret it then, do you think?
I don't regret rejoining the fall. Who would? Why would you? No. I'd made my mind up nothing was going to make me leave this time because, you know, it was a good going concern, good things to be part of.
Yeah.
But I couldn't stop myself getting fired. That's the only thing I couldn't stop happening. So there you go.
So do you honestly believe that he got you back in just so he could fire you as a punishment for leaving?
It felt like that, yeah. He was pretty frosty with me, but then he was with everyone at that point. Yeah. I'm saying it flippantly, obviously.
Of course, I
don't actually believe he did that.
No.
It just felt like that.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Well, there must have been a bit of history then, even subconsciously.
Well, I believe when he was very drunk one night in Australia, I wasn't there, but he was screaming at Marcia that I was the man who stole his wife. Well, I had never met Bricks, who was his only wife at that point, so I could only imagine he meant Una, but, I mean, they'd been split up for a year before I started seeing her, so whatever. But that's the kind of atmosphere that was around by Australia, you know, bonkers.
Do you remember of that time, Steve? Was it particularly fraught for you, or do you have a better memory of that?
I do remember a lot of arguments between Martin and Mark, but I don't know.
Chipping Norton, that was the big argument.
Chipping Norton, yeah.
He fired me that night, but then reinstated me for Australia, so, yeah.
What happened in Chipping Norton?
We were recording that Dredger EP, weren't we?
Yeah.
You know, Blood Out of Stone and White Lightning and all that.
Life
it was the night that... Lou Reed and John Cale were being broadcast on the BBC. Their album Songs for Drella had a BBC special.
Right. Yeah.
And you, Stephen, Craig and Mark went to the pub, and I stayed in the lodgings we had. Well, it was like a living studio, wasn't it?
Mm.
No. Big sort of Tudor farmhouse. And so I was in the kitchen watching Lou Reed on the anyway, we had a big row. I was sat there with Marsha, actually. So he came back and thought I was being too friendly with Marsha. That's the issue, obviously. And so we had a big row in the kitchen where he tried to smash a whiskey bottle over me. But he didn't do it. But,
no.
And I told him what I thought of him, and so he fired me. But then I got reinstated the next morning. Thanks to Steve again, the mediator. reinstated.
But again, I mean, you can talk about regrets, but you did get to go, you know, you did get to walk to Australia, so it was...
I'm not regretting anything. You're the one talking about regrets.
Tell you, Martin, when I say you can talk about regrets, I meant one can talk about regrets, not you.
Exactly.
Not you personally.
Quite.
Yeah. But it's not really worth regretting these things, because it's your life, isn't it? I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah,
nice. No, I mean, I've probably said this before, but there is a I've thought this a lot over the last few years. It was a different thing when you were in it and you're fully involved in it.
Yeah.
It did seem like a different world that
normal
rules of how to be a human being didn't apply.
Yeah, you're a cult member while you're in, aren't you? Mind control.
So after that ignominious departure, is that when you restarted up Blue Orchids then, was it?
Yeah, pretty sharpish. A new lineup of Blue Orchids, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why did you decide to call it Factory Star for a bit?
Back in the day. Because all the baggage with the name Blue Orchids, I suppose, I wanted to do something new because I had a break.
Yeah, but that's your baggage. It's not even like the Fall. It's all you, the Blue Orchids, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's been pointed out to me that, you know, that's a label I should live with because it's a commercially viable label, flag to fly under.
I'm
Blue Orchids now, but for a while I just wanted to move on, you know, associate it with other people. I just wanted a fresh start, new name, which is naive. Creatively it's fine, but it's not practical as far as getting gigs and etc. Yeah. You keep changing your name and it's harder to put you in the marketplace, isn't it? So I'm aware of that.
It's funny, isn't it, the difference the name makes, because, I mean, you with some people could easily be Factory Star and it could easily be the Blue Orchids, but for some reason people will go and see the Blue Orchids. Why don't they know? I don't understand the logic, but it's, if you've got the name, it's a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, more so nowadays, I think, because when there were like three music papers coming out every week, there was more coverage of your progress, you know. So I think if you changed your name and got an interview in NME, then people were up to speed. Everybody was reading them. Everybody interested in music was reading them three papers every week. And so now it's much more diffuse. So people just don't know where to look and find out these things unless they're really into you and are following you online and stuff.
But, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, you got to kind of stick.
Well, I suppose there is that. That if you're calling yourself Factory Star, you may not necessarily be doing Blue Orchids material.
Yeah, well, you know, that's true. Yeah. Did a few, didn't we? A couple of Fall songs, a couple of Blue Orchids, a few new ones.
Did you? Because when we did Factory Star, I got the impression you kind of struggled with that sort of owning it and moving on from it. It was a kind of constant sort of backward and forth for you. Yeah, is that true?
I've always had to sort of manage that on my own terms, you know, the Fall connection, because obviously the Fall's a big name you can't escape. We're all kind of, to me, we're all part of this extended dysfunctional Fall family, aren't we? You can't leave the Fall, really. You know what I mean? Unless you become a hermit. So we're all kind of still part of this Fall family, aren't we? But so how you deal with that is your own thing, isn't it? I mean, I did find it hard towards the end with us three, because it's like three times the Fall baggage, as I've said before.
Yeah.
You've got your way of dealing with it, I've got my way of dealing with it. And people's expectations, we're getting more Fall fans coming to see us, but they didn't like us doing Fall songs, even though we were just stuck a couple in at the end to please them. But it's like, you can't stand on your own 2 feet, lads, why are you doing Fall songs?
And, yeah, yeah. They do have that, don't they?
You can't win.
No, you can't. No, I mean, we've had that with the Extricated as well. It's the same thing. They like you to do four songs, but they never think you do them justice.
And the songs you've written or helped write, you're entitled to play them. But anyway, maybe it's changed now that Mark's no longer with us, but I've not tried them. I've done the odd four song, actually, in Blue Orchids. I do Before the Moon Falls in the set. But I was doing a couple of years ago now. But
that'll be not the version that's on Dragnet, right. Obviously. Was it a different song, or was it?
I did a mashup of Work and Before the Moon Falls and called it Work Before the Moon Falls.
Brilliant.
That's a good. That worked well in the live set, and I just mashed the two together.
I've never understood why that thing with Factory Starr, why you wouldn't be enormously proud and present the early Blue Orchid stuff as much as possible, because I mean it was a fantastic band, and without being too sycophantic, to come back with that, which was so different from The Fall, it was kind of like The Fall but different at the same time. I thought it was a brilliant achievement, Blue Orchids.
Yeah, well, I can't argue with that. I was deliberately trying to not sound like The Fall, of course. I didn't want to just be like another Fall spin. Yeah. So I made an effort, you know, to get a different kind of sound together. But after a while, you feel like you're sort of tying one hand behind your back, because sounding like The Fall is quite natural to me as well, because I help create the sound. So yes. I kind of relax that now. And what I'm doing now has more elements of Fall sound in it, because
right.
Why not? It's like I say, I don't want to self-edit stuff out that comes out. No,
definitely not. But as I say, that's what I could never get with it, because, you know, you would, you know, calling yourself something else and having mostly new songs, but then I suppose that's something that The Fall's always done as well, hasn't it? They've kind of left their old stuff behind.
That's the thing, isn't it? You've got to keep moving on and making new stuff. You know, that's my approach. I'm always more interested in the new stuff that's more exciting, you know. You've got to play some old standards for people who want to come and see you, but it's getting a balance, isn't it? Getting the set list.
Yeah.
I mean, we're putting our first gig coming up is in Ebden Bridge on the July the 23rd coming up. That'll be the first gig coming out of lockdown, and that's going to have stuff on it. We're going to be playing stuff that's on the next album that's not even recorded yet, so we are getting new stuff in the set, which is part of the tradition, what's expected. Lots of stuff off the current album that's out, you know, June the 25th.
What's the lineup now of
we've got Howard Jones on drums,
right.
Vince Hunt on bass.
Oh, Howard.
Right. Yeah, he's a well-known face around Manchester.
Yeah.
We've got, of course, John Paul Moran on keyboards. He's
brilliant.
Legend, absolute legend.
Yeah. Brilliant keyboard player.
Been for like 11 years now or something, as you know.
Yeah.
So, we've got Tansy McNally on the electric ukulele, which is a psychedelic revelation. She's we've flown her in from Melbourne, Australia. She's that special. And me on guitar and vocals, of course. So we're a five-piece now.
Yeah. Right.
And, that's the lineup for the current album that's out later this month. Yeah.
You're doing some gigs with the Nightingales, is that right?
Yeah, in November we're going to do a bit of a mini tour around Scotland and a London date as well. And Newcastle, to be fair.
Great.
Yeah, you know, in November, yeah. We've got quite a few gigs coming up this year. Tentatively, because, you know, God willing, with all this...
Right, well... I think we're about up to date now, aren't we? So it's been good to talk to you, Martin.
It has, I really enjoyed it.
You managed to record last year then?
Yeah, in July, sort of. It was we rehearsed for 3 days and recorded for 3 days and did a whole album in 3 days, playing live in the studio in the beginning of July last year, There was a little window, so we got it done.
It's the only way to record that, isn't it? Playing live like
that's
that.
That's the way I know, and I stick to it now. I do it just the way we learn doing Peel sessions. You always get the best sound if you've got the band playing together with a decent studio.
Yeah, definitely.
That's what I know how to do, and it saves money as well. It's like, you've got the live feel, though. You've got that energy, playing with each other. Which,
definitely.
Yeah. I can always make that work, so.
Yep. All right, mate.
All right.
Well, it's good to speak to you. Take care. I hope the gigs go. I hope they take place, first of all, and I hope they go really well.
Thank you.
But when we have this big night out for everyone who's been on the podcast, you'll have to come along.
Yeah, totally, yeah. I'm newly back in Manchester as well this week.
Oh, yeah?
All
right.
Good news, yeah. So,
All right, mate.
All right, see you soon.
Okay.
Ta-da. All right.
Thanks for joining us again on Old Brother. Episodes are released every second Friday, so watch for episode 10 in 2 weeks. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find a link to Spotify and subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes or tell your friends about us. For further reading, you can check out our books, published by Root Publishers and available from all good bookstores. Hope to speak to you again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.